Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room today, Barbara Sittler is speaking on grief at life's end. So let's listen to Barbara.
I see this session really as sort of a culmination of a week's worth of conversation that some of us have had about the whole issue of dying, of getting older, of facing very different challenges to who we are and who we are in terms of our family, in terms of our own physical being, and in terms of any kind of community that we are involved in that we find meaningful. For most people at Holden, that's going to be the Lutheran Church, but I by no means see that as restricted. What my comments are is restrictive to that idea. And as I've said at every session, anytime you want to say something, please just start in. This is very much, I think, the most that we get from these things is what we share with each other. I'll tell you a little bit. Some of you have already heard this. I'll tell you a little bit about why I'm involved in this and why this is such an important topic for me. I'm one of six children. My father was a Lutheran pastor and then stopped being a pastor of a congregation and became a professor of theology. And he lived for a long time, relatively speaking. He lived till he was 83. He thought that was probably pretty much long enough. And he faced a number of physical setbacks during his later years. He became very hard of hearing, and his vision was even worse. But he managed to continue to work. He was on the faculty at the University of Chicago Divinity School till he retired. Then he went and was an emeritus professor at the Lutheran School of Theology. And he kept up his relationship in one way or another till he died, really up until about the day he died. With a lot of help from people who would come and read to him. And he did a lot of work on aging. My mother was raised Lutheran. She was a musician, homemaker, a mother, a real mother. She loved having kids. She loved being with kids. She was a mother. And she started getting ill, 25 years before she died. And she had a gradually progressing disease similar to multiple sclerosis, and she gradually developed Alzheimer's. And so by the time that she died, she had been bedridden for maybe 7 years, had been unable to speak or eat for 3.5. We had a feeding tube put in her, keep her going. Both of them spent most of their bad times at home, and both of them died at home. And particularly with the death of my father, because he was so alive and because his mind and his intellect were so significant to him, important to his own self-definition, when he died, there was a very big break in the life of the family. There was a very big break in my life. I had spent all of my life up until his death working as a professional chef and was just starting to go back to college at age 38 or 39 to finish a college education that I had interrupted in the late 60s and early 70s. And I was studying theology, and I wanted him more then than I ever had. Mm-hmm. So it was a very difficult time for me. When my mother died 3 years later, it was also a very difficult time because I had watched her die for years. And she hated it. She absolutely hated it. And as long as she was able to talk about what she was doing, what she was experiencing, she talked about it in terms of despair and of anger and of feeling a sense of helplessness. And she said, I can't do anything. I can't cook anymore. I can't do the laundry. Well, my mother was at best an indifferent housekeeper all her life. She always said, okay, Daddy's going to have students and faculty over. We always have to keep the living room clean. But the rest of the house was always in a sort of a mild state of chaos all our lives. Mm-hmm. And I said, Mom, you never did much in the way of cleaning anyway. Who cares now? But she really, her own definition was that she was a wife and a mother and a woman, and she had particular goals and responsibilities that she was failing to carry out. And as her oldest daughter, I felt really powerless to try to help her change her own definition of herself and to let her know that her music was far more significant to most of us than her housekeeping ever was, and that she was our mother and that she was someone we loved and needed and cared for regardless of whether she was standing or sitting or lying. And I, for the first year after my father's death, I went into a very severe depression, and have given that a lot of thought since those times. It's been it will be almost 7 years now. Given a lot of thought to why it was that I was so depressed. And I think one of the major reasons that I was so depressed was because he was so depressed. And here was someone who had spent his life in the church, much of his life as a pastor, the later years of his life not only as a teacher but as a pastor. He spent as much time preaching and at conferences. He was up here. He did as much in a sort of a pastoral capacity as he did in a strictly academic capacity. And he had devoted the end of his life to questions of aging. And yet, as he faced his own death and his own diminishment, which he started getting really ill about 15 months before he finally died, he was in a terrible state. He was terribly depressed, and he couldn't bear what was happening to him. And I thought that was very interesting. If nothing else, it was very hard to watch. And I started to think about the resources that we may have had at the time that we didn't find we could use, and about what I could do to change that. Now, one of the most obvious resources that I thought was available, perhaps wasn't available, should have been, could have been, maybe could have been used differently, was obviously the church. And I think that's one thing I want to explore today, is what the church does for us in talking to us clearly and directly about those times in our life, be they times of aging or death or any times in which despair, depression, loss confronts us and we find ourselves bereft of help. Other resources that could have been there that somehow weren't were the Bible itself. And I think during this week, I've only been able to be at Susan Briel's Bible class, Bible study twice, but at both times she talked about lament, some of the Psalms in the Psalter that deal with lament, and how we don't really incorporate those Psalms, those feelings, in the life of the church, in the life of our worship, and in our conversations together about what it is to be a child of God. We speak about unconditional love, about recognizing the presence of God among us, about being able to turn to the Psalter and have this ongoing conversation with God that reminds us of our relationship with God, that God knows us better than we know ourselves, and yet somehow many of us are not able to access that. Or we're able to access that only once we've passed the time of real despair, that we somehow feel that we have to guts it out, or that despair is truly a blank place, a place of silence, a place, as Susan was speaking about, when we go to Sheol, it is a place where God no longer is, except in the psalm that she read today, that it's a place of silence. It's a place where we are in isolation. We are left out. And there's an incredible amount of richness within the Psalter itself and within Old and New Testament that I think that we as a community of Christian believers could access to help ourselves individually, help ourselves as families, and help ourselves as communities, congregations working together. I was talking to Martin this morning, Martin Wells, Susan's husband, and one of the directors here, and I saying, oh man, you know, I've got to do this class, and I have so much to say, but I don't really know how to say it. And he said, well, you know, there's, of course, Joshua. And I said, well, of course there's Joshua. What do you mean, of course there's Joshua? And he said, well, you know, there's the story when Joshua goes to the Hebrew people and he's facing the time of his own death. And it's a time of tremendous grief for him because he goes to them. Let me see. I've taken out the... He even had to tell me where to find it. So I'll have to look for it, Joshua. Joshua has been with the Hebrew people for a long time, has gotten them settled. This is what you do. We've got society set up here. We've crossed the desert. We've been here. Now, this is what, I'm dying, so I've got to tell you. This is what you got to do, all right? This is, Joshua summoned all Israel, their elders and heads, their judges and officers, and said to them, I am now old and well advanced in years. And he starts to do a whole list of instructions to them, meaning I'm old, I'm moving on. This is what you have to do. You have seen all that the Lord your God has done to these nations for your sake. For it is the Lord your God who fought for you. I have allotted to you as an inheritance for your tribes these nations that remain. And he goes on about where they're located. He said, therefore, be very steadfast to observe and do all that is written in the law, in the book of the law of Moses, turning aside from it neither to the right, to the left. Now that I am about to go to on the way of all the earth, and you know in your heart and soul, all of you, that not one thing has failed of all the good things that the Lord your God promised concerning to you. All have come to pass for you. Not one of them has failed. Well, now he's saying two things here. He's reminding everyone, this is the covenant. It's come to pass. You are here. The God said all of these things would happen. See? They did happen. Stick with them. Stay with them. What's underlying what he's saying is, I'm not going to be here. You've got to remember. You got to do it. Now listen to what I'm telling you. Listen to what I'm telling you. He says it over and over and over again. Remember, I got you here. This is what the Lord said. I have to remind you of this thing and this thing and this thing. What is so significant to me in these pages is not what it is that he's reminding the people, the Hebrew people of, but the fact that he sees his life slipping away and he can't bear it. He's got to keep reminding them over and over and over again. Do this, and everything will be all right. I have to keep telling you because I'm not going to be here to see that it's going to work out. And he's terrified of that, and he's in despair that he is, in fact, leaving this world of living. He's leaving this sense of engagement with his people, and he can't control what's going to come after. When I think back at my father, he would sit there and he would rage that he couldn't work it all out. Mm-hmm. I remember going in there, I'm one of two girls. My younger sister had gotten married to a man that my father approved of tremendously, and she had two children, the twins who are coming up later. And Dad was really happy about that, but he would pound on his knee or pound on whatever he was holding his lap. He said, damn it, Barbara, I just want to see you settled. And he would get angrier and angrier with me that he didn't see me settled. And I would say, you know, Dad, I'd kind of like to see myself settled too. I don't know that I think that my being settled is the same as being married and with children, although I don't have any problem with that. But it was as if he was blaming me for not being settled. Mm-hmm. And I could see that he was so disturbed that that as life was going, he didn't himself have the confidence that it would be all right. That somehow the very faith that he had insisted was the core of life was insufficient at that time to carry him through. Now, I would maintain that's not just my dad's problem. That's something that each and every one of us face when we come to times of endings or of diminishment or of a loss of control. We hope God's there. When it's a beautiful day like this and don't have to cook, and, you know, things are wonderful, it's pretty easy to believe that God's there and the light is shining on our lives. And yes, God is in front of us and behind us and blessing us, and it's a wonderful feeling. But what about those times when we can't get those? We can't grasp those feelings. And I think that is the time that we have to start to turn back to the Bible, turn back to our tradition, and start to pull out the stories that will speak to us of those times. Joshua's raging at people. Remember, remember. Well, what is he also saying? I won't be here. I don't like that. I feel terrible about that. The other side of the grief, when we look at aging and grief and how we go through that, is that as we watch those we love around us getting older, as I watched my parents getting older, as I watched my oldest brother getting older, as I watched myself getting older, I wonder, how will I be remembered? Have I left anything for people to access? Will they say, oh, I'm living this way because of the example my aunt set me? Look, my brother went before me, and I saw that he did that, and it was good, and it maintained the tradition, and I like that. I want that. What will I do when my brother isn't here any longer? What will I do when my last remaining uncle is gone? And I feel a tremendous amount of grief at that. Now, I can also say, but he will go into the eternal life of unity with God. Sometimes that helps, and sometimes it's such an ambiguous promise. It's such an unknowable mystery that I don't know what that means. Where's my mom? Where's my dad? Toward the end of his life, Dad was asked to give a lecture. There were a number of people who were asked to give. If you had one lecture left to give, what would it be? And he responded, he loved talking. And he talked about Romans 14. And it was what he picked for his funeral also. And it's all about welcome to those who are weak in faith. Some like to eat vegetables, some like to eat meat, some don't like to abstain. We shouldn't pass judgment on each other for what we choose, because the implication here is that we all come to God differently, but the point is that we all come, some by being a vegetarian, some by wallowing in as a flesh pot, I don't know. Some will judge one day to be better than another, while others judge all days to be alike. Let all be fully convinced in their own minds. But remember, we do not live to ourselves, and we do not die to ourselves. If we live, we live to the Lord. And if we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. And what he came up with, and what I've thought about often since then, is that he said, you know, Paul was asked, what's going to happen when we die? And that's the best that Paul could come up with. Well, when we live, we're gods. When we die, we're gods. Doesn't flesh it out much more. It's a big mystery. But what that meant was that in the eyes of God, I will never not have been. And that may just have to be enough. Well, I hope it is. I really do. And there are times I think there's a good theological sense in that, but it's not the kind of stuff that I can access as a grieving daughter, or as someone who faces my own time of death, or as someone who looks around, even at the devastation in Rwanda, and look at all those thousands of people who are dying every day, and say, what does this mean? And I think that is really, these are the kinds of questions that really contribute to the heart of grief, that we don't know. We can't rest comfortably in what we're told, or in what the church chooses to put out as comforting elements that we can access in times of diminishment and loss and grief. I have a real problem with our current habit of making all funerals celebrations of the life of Beth, Joe, whomever, that this is a time in which we will celebrate the life of the person who has now passed on. I love the idea of celebration. As a chef, I've made a business out of it. And I think that celebration and joy and love are wonderful things. But I think that we jump too easily from death to celebration, as if we have to quickly jump over that moment of silence and despair. Let's celebrate the life. What happened? Wait, I can't celebrate right now. I just lost someone I love very much. And to me, I feel the loss. I feel the loss. I don't feel the joy that they are now living at the side of God. And so part of the reason I was passing these things around, and that I think it's very important that people start to work within the church, if they are part of a church community, within a culture, as we are in a culture that really tries very much not to speak of death and of loss and of narrowing of focuses, narrowing of possibilities and of options, is that we start to say, wait, this is not helping us. This is not good. I could get into a big economic and social critique of our society that insists that we constantly move out and ever larger and grander, so that we, you know, we're consuming our own resources. We're consuming more than we have to work with. But I think if we narrow it down to how we see the issues of grief in terms of personal relationships, we can also say, you know, part of what we see as grief is could be avoided if we could see that life and death are what we are born into, and that perhaps we can be sorry for changes in how we live, in the narrowing of some of the things that we can do, but also see these times as possibilities for opening new possibilities, to say, yes, we are dying. Yes, you are dying. A part of me is dying with you. I will grieve you. What does this mean? What can we get out of this? Can we acknowledge the bitterness and the grief and the despair and the loneliness? Can we read the Psalm 88 that Susan Brill mentioned the other day, which is the psalm that is never in any hymnal, because it is so bleak? And can we then talk about what that brings up for us? Dad, if you feel so bad, why do you feel so bad? Why are you so angry that you haven't seen me settled? Because I love you. Because I love you. Now that's the positive side of this terrible despair. Why did I feel so badly that I lost my father and my mother? Because I love them. Because they gave life meaning to me. I had a relationship with them for my mother of absolutely joyful love. She thought that anything we kids did was wonderful. I never had that again in my life, and it was a tremendous thing. Oh, and she laughed all the time. She loved a good story. She loved a good joke. She loved music. She loved, if we wanted to bring our friends over, absolutely, bring them over. The table was always big enough to add more people. That's the other side of the grief that I feel, that there's no one manning that table anymore. I wish that I had thought to read with her, and when she could no longer speak to me and possibly no longer hear me, but very possibly could, that I had thought to read Psalm 88. I'll read a little bit of it now because it really does get to the heart of it. I should have brought my glasses. O Lord, God of my salvation, when at night I cry out in your presence, let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my cry. For my soul is full of troubles, and my life draws near to Sheol. I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am like those who have no help, like those forsaken among the dead, like the slain that lie in the grave, like those whom you remember no more, for they are cut off from your hand. You have put me in the depths of the pit, in the regions dark and deep. Your wrath lies heavy upon me, and you overwhelm me with all your waves. You have caused my companions to shun me. You have made me a thing of horror to them. I am shut in so that I cannot escape. My eye grows dim through sorrow. Every day I call on you, O Lord. I spread out my hands to you. Do you work wonders for the dead? Do the shades rise up to praise you? Is your steadfast love declared in the grave, or your faithfulness in Abaddon? Are your wonders known in the darkness, or your saving help in the land of forgetfulness? But I, O Lord, cry out to you. In the morning my prayer comes before you. O Lord, why do you cast me off? Why do you hide your face from me? Wretched and close to death, from my youth up, I suffer your terrors. I am desperate. Your wrath has swept over me. Your dread assaults destroy me. They surround me like a flood all day long. From all sides, they close in on me. You have caused friend and neighbor to shun me. My companions are in darkness. That's how it felt. It's certainly how it felt to me. I believe, looking on the way my mother's face changed over those years when she could no longer speak and she couldn't do anything about this prison that she was in, I believe that at least part of the time, that's how she felt. We need to give words to that. We need to acknowledge that. There are no members of my family who will go to church any longer. No one came to see those people when they were dying. I mean, a few people, that's not exactly true, but the church found itself unable to express for itself the despair that was evident in the actual physical ravages of these people they had before them. It's not just my family. It's many, many people who are dying. I see now in my generation, so many of my friends are dying of AIDS. I have a list that's now, it's beyond two dozen people who I have known and worked with, my age and younger, who have died. Many of them have died alone. Many of them were not members of a church. I don't see that that makes any difference, because as communities in which we see our goal as reaching out, as bringing God's will in, God's word into the world, we can bring that into the hospices, into the hospitals. We can speak, be with them in their despair, but we have to be willing to face how much that frightens us ourselves. And I think we start looking at how much that frightens us and working past that fear by starting it in little bits from the time we're children. We're told not only how wonderful we are, how much we can do, but that life has limitations, that life is a finite period, that there will be things that happen that are not good, and that yet we are not shunned, we are not put in a way of silence, we are not cast away from conversation about that tragedy. Not conversations around it or hopscotching over it. I know, or maybe I don't know. Tell me. I have no answers. Tell me. Let me be there with you. Let me work this through this with you. And my pet peeve, if I were the president of all of the seminaries in the country, I would demand that all of the seminary students take a real intensive course on grief and on death and on diminishment and on loss, because I think that we have this happy church, this church of empowerment, church of inclusivity. I have nothing against that. I love the fact that we're changing language. Last night I was at the concert. Were any of you at Linda Allen's thing? Where she sang that song about, I can't call you Father, about God, about how meaningful it was that there was a movement within the church to change the language with which we refer to God. I found that very, very important, very meaningful. I think that's all great, but I also think that what we're saying is, if we can all just get together here, we'll be a big, happy world. This flies in the face of reality. We need to try that. We need to push love and understanding and compassion out, but we need also to acknowledge the very deep bitternesses that we have, the very fact that we fail and that we don't understand, and that sometimes God's love is manifested in very strange ways. I lost track of my thought. I had something here I was going to move into. And the seminary students are working so much on the inclusiveness of our church and on growing in joyfulness that I frequently wonder who they're talking to. I go to the church when I need help, a lot of times, when I need to know the songs, the hymns being sung over and over and over again are a tradition, it's something from my childhood, it's something I remember. I want to go there to talk about the tragedies that go on in life. And it's a good group of people, or it's good for me when I can find a group of people with whom we can say, yes, it was bitter, and I hurt, and I can't figure it out. Moses goes through the whole 40 years, fights God, doesn't want to go on this trip in the first place. God appears in the burning bush. No, Moses, you're going to do it. Oh, I can't speak well. Yeah, you're going to do it anyway. Well, how about my brother? No, you're going to do it. Your brother can help you. Goes through the whole 40 years getting these Israelites across the desert, moaning and groaning and building golden calves and squabbling about the food that they're eating and constantly veering off, only to get to Mount Nebo to see the promised land. Look, Moses, right down there. You're up at Heart Lake. It's all downhill. And you'll get to Holden, and everything's going to be great. Clean sheets, hot shower, food. You're not going to get there, though. You're going to stay up here on Mount Nebo. What? I did all of this. I did it all. And I'm just going to see the promise of the promised land. I'm not going to get there. That's a lesson that we could lift up a lot more in our sermons and in our community life, I think, to talk about those lessons within our tradition that talk to us about almost getting it there, or the frustration of failing, of doing your best and not looking back at the end of your life and saying, I wanted to do this and this and this, and I almost did. But I'm not gonna. And I'm heartbroken. So these are some of the thoughts that I have about what we could do as a community, about what and what we can do as individuals moving out. I hope I'm not painting too black a picture or talking about things in such a way that I am not lifting up the joyousness that we can also receive by reading through the other Psalms, by being part of a community, by seeing that life in fact does go on. I think I was telling you, I'm not sure, that I was horrified. Absolutely horrified. My father died in right after Christmas. And it was a particularly cold winter in Chicago. Just Chicago, because there are no hills. I mean, that wind can come off the lake and it'll just freeze you to your core. And his funeral was on an even colder day. I mean, it was just frigid. Perfect. Seemed perfect to me. And several months later, I was sitting at my desk working on schoolwork and just sort of, I don't really remember those times very well. It was just such a bad time. And I looked out the window. I lived on the second floor of an apartment building. There was this tree-lined street, and there was a big tree that had been scratching against my window, the empty branches during the winter with the wind. And I looked over, and there were green buds. I couldn't believe that the green was there, that the world was continuing to work and to regenerate. I remember just sitting there staring at those branches thinking, what? Spring is coming? It was completely beyond my comprehension. And I was angry. And I thought, well, what a ridiculous thing. I can't tell anybody I'm angry that spring is coming. I mean, well, my father died and spring is coming. This is an outrageous, you know, thing. But I wanted to be able to. I wanted to talk about that horror and that sense that to me life had stopped. You're get over it. You're going to be fine. He's dead now. He was an old man. He would have wanted this way. He was suffering. It's much better. I'm sure he's much happier where he is now. Don't tell me that. Don't tell me that. He's gone. My family's splitting apart. I don't have anybody to talk to about what I'm going back to school for. He would have been so happy. I got an A on my first paper. Don't tell me that it's better like this, and I'll get over it. I'll never get over it. Well, the next spring was an entirely different thing. I quite enjoyed the next spring. And that's a process that we go through, but that first spring, and there was no, the church, we don't make use of the laments. And so how can we make use of the songs of praise? They have so much less meaning if they're not put together. If we don't have winter, how can we love spring? And God created it this way. We do have winter. We do have birth and death. We do have gain and loss. We need to understand in a very real way that this is the structure of human existence. This is the structure of created reality. And we can pull up the lament, and we can pull up the song of praise, and we can experience life far more richly if we have them both there to be acknowledged, to be worked through, to be spoken in conversation with each other and with God. That's the other thing that Susan said this morning, that she said over and over, that I really love, is that the Psalter itself is a conversational mechanism. It's a way in which we talk to God. We can express what we feel, as it has been expressed in so many ways in these Psalms. Not only the joy, but the terrible bitterness. The 23rd Psalm can rest alongside that Psalm that I just read. And I would argue has a great deal more meaning as a result of being read along with it.
I think one of the gifts the church can give is to honor the wisdom and experience of people who have faced grief and loss of loved ones. And I think that's a ministry that hasn't been explored and encouraged enough. But having faced the loss of a mother, it was very comforting to me to have someone who's gone through that be with me and share their experiences. And I think that we need to encourage discussion about death and dying as a natural process from a Christian's perspective, and just listen to other people's stories, because that's how I know that the promise works. I might not have experienced the loss myself or the grief, but if I hear enough stories of people who have gone through the hard times and have found a certain strength in a scripture verse or in the arm of a friend, then I can trust that when my time comes, that promise is going to hold true for me too. And there are wonderful authors who write about this. One of them is C.S. Lewis, and he has a beautiful book called A Grief Observed. And he just starts a journal from about a month after his wife dies. And the first parts of it are just, oh, they're just heart-wrenching. But he keeps it for about a year after she dies, and it's in his writing, it's an unfolding of how his grief has a natural course to it. But at the end, there's the realization that his wife is very much still a force to be dealt with, just as I feel now. It's in a spiritual realm, though, and he can still hear her. And my hope is that at some point you can say that my father, though he isn't here in person, he is still there. And I feel that with my mother. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if any of you have the same experience too, but there's a different shape and relationship that happens once that person goes out of your life. And I think we need to say this to people who have lost or are just experiencing imminent death or something, or have just lost someone, that this is not really the end of your relationship with this person. This relationship is just taking on a different dimension. The dance is going to take a different step, is the way C.S. Lewis put it. You know, when we were together, we danced our dance a certain way. Now the dance still goes on, but the step changes, you know. And that's a comfort to me, and that's the whole promise. And the communion of saints thing to me is that Martin Luther's been long gone, but his words still have an impact on my life, or the psalmist is gone. But that relationship didn't stop. Doesn't stop. It still goes on. And so I would like to hear stories of other people who have suffered loss and grief. and know if any of you have the same experience, or would, I mean, I love to tell my story of my loss and my grief, because it makes my mother still alive in a way, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Easter...
I don't want to talk about it.
Easter after... Was it the Easter after my dad died? I believe it was the first Easter. He died at Christmas time. I think it was the first Easter. It may have been the one after, but I'm pretty sure it was just that few months later. I was a member of a Lutheran church in Chicago, still am, and Bishop Chilstrom was coming to preach for Easter. And you know, it was a big deal. And the pastor, who's a very close friend of mine, said that Bishop Chilstrom and his wife, Corrine, will be having lunch with us afterwards. Would you care to join us? And I said, well, sure. You know. And it was it was the first Easter. First of all, in the sermon that he gave, he mentioned my dad, that he had something that he had done that reflected him. That was just such an amazing thing. But at lunch, they spoke a great deal about the suicide of their son. And they said that it was absolute, they had to talk about it. They had to talk about the love they had for their son, and how devastating it was. They told in incredible detail the night that he came home, how they had gone to sleep, the sound that they heard, how he had gone downstairs to find him and wouldn't let his wife see, you know, the suicide in the basement. And they have written a great deal about that. Corrine has come out with a book on it, and they constantly talk about it. They lift that up as being something very important. We have to confront those things. I forgot about that until you're just saying it. And this morning I was really debating I don't like using one's own life as sort of a template for all of life. My story is everyone's story. That's not it. But yet, I think that we have to lift up those stories, because then
it brings in
your story and maybe someone else's story.
Uh-huh.
And that.
Story too.
Well, I do think that one of the comforting things that Aunt told me was that I said I cannot remember him in any way but as a sick man.
Your father?
Yeah, and she said that it's a wonderful thing that it may take a year or two, but then you won't remember the sick man.
Oh.
You'll remember the well person.
Did you?
Yeah, well, definitely. The same with my mother.
Yeah, it's... I think that we shy away from these things because they can bring up such tremendously powerful emotions. Terribly powerful. A couple of times just this week when Susan's been talking about different things, different laments, I mean, I have just been crying because it just... It reminds me of how horrible it was. Some of those moments when I just felt left alone, but it's really important. The severe depression lasted a year, full year. And I remember I was at work, and it was the anniversary of my father's death. And I was going to leave early, and we were all going to have, we all gathered together to have Dad's favorite dinner, which was sauerkraut, roast pork and sauerkraut with these horrible dumplings he used to make. And we finally figured out that if we just put a little baking soda in there, it made all the difference. So, and dark beer. And it just sort of happened. We didn't ever talk about it. Just sort of, what are you doing on the 28th? And, you know, we all... And I thought, oh, God, a year ago today. And I had found him dead. And I knew, as soon as he was diagnosed, somehow I had this, one of those weird things, it's going to be me. And it was. And I thought, geez, it's been a full year. I still feel as bad as I did a year ago. And I went to the bathroom and just started to cry and cry. And one of the people who I work with came in and she said, what's the matter? And I said, it's a year. It's supposed to be done in a year. You know, I'm supposed to be better now. And she was great. She said, oh, you know, come on. It's over when it's over. You know, it'll never be really over. But I remember thinking, my God, it's been a full year. And it's as, I feel as, I mean, slapped, just ripped out of all life, and nothing was worth a damn. And I had to force myself every day to just get up. But then, as I say, then the next spring came along and...
Time.
Now, I still miss him. I think it's probably very clear. I miss both my parents very, very much. But I miss them in a different way. And the lessons that they have given me have been things that I find are very... the step is different. I'm much stronger now. Because I also know that I was able to go through it. I know I never want anyone else to go through it in that way. To the extent that I am capable, I want to put my life to work in making sure that I can offer help to people who go through that as well. So that's why I'm teaching these classes this week. I also want to have a roaring good time, which is why it's going to be theology and food next week. But, you know, it's a different thing. It certainly was by no means a year, and there are moments. I when I came here, I went to the tape library, and with enormous fear, looked to see if there were tapes of my dad, and there were. And I put one on, and... Couldn't do it. Now, I ordered all of them. I've got the copies. But I can't hear his voice yet. And it's been, as I say, in December, it'll be 7 years.
I wish I had a voice of my dad. Mm-hmm. My dad died 7 years ago.
Ah, how is it for you?
No, I think I worked through it. And it took a while, I would say, doing most of it. I was the executor to me.
Uh-huh.
And I think that helped, even though it was so painful.
I bet it did.
That really helped. And I think that's all I can say, that part was the most painful doing that, but I think that helped immensely.
Well, it was his connection with you. You were still working with him. In a way, you were carrying out his wishes.
When my husband died, I looked all over for grief groups in the church. Not finding them. They find them at the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something?
Yeah, and I look at our church now, and there are so many people there that have lost spouses and things, but we're all just our own little.
Yeah, and we're left alone.
It would be such a great ministry, I think, mm-hmm. for people who have worshiped together and have, experienced the life together. Death should be so much part of that, mm-hmm. that it should seem a natural group
to be gathered together.
Yes, and I just thought that was so weird.
Do your seminaries not have?
Well, I'm now getting my Master of Divinity at the University of Chicago, which is not affiliated with any particular seminary, but with the whole cluster. So in our three-year course, we do not have courses specific to death. Now we do have, we are all on field placements. And then we gather together once a week in a practicum to sort of debrief what's going on, and it will be raised then. But it's not a specific issue. I think that's a real mistake. I don't know for a fact that the seminaries, for example, if I go to be ordained, then I'll have to spend a Lutheran year at LSTC or, you know, the other Methodist, Presbyterian. I don't know that they don't have it, but from what I understand, they don't. Most of them do not, as an explicit area of ministry. And I, you know, there's nothing, you know, I want to say that one, a couple of sure things in life, death and taxes, and we're not dealing with it?
Well, some time ago, our women's organization decided that we wanted to do something about the lack of having any real information or conversation, etc. So we planned a whole Saturday with some college information coming in and so on. One of the speakers that we had from Portland State, a gentleman, who was an expert in the field, came and helped us in the planning of the day. And because it was open to not just women, but to their spouses and anybody who wanted to come, he was very clear about, almost hesitant to say this, but about the differences between men and women and wanting to talk about death and dying. And he said, we can present the things in kind of this classroom situation in the beginning. But when we break into workshops, and then there were, you had a chance to go, there were probably 10 different workshops, and you could go to 3 of them during the afternoons. He said, I'll take the men, because to tell you the truth, the men don't want to face this until they face it. And that's their attitude of, don't tell me or don't talk to me about my spouse dying, because when it happens, I'll deal with it. But I don't want to do all this, how I'm going to do it, and who's going to help me through it, and what should I be thinking about, and, you know, ahead of time. That I just, I don't want to have anything to do with that. And that was just shocking to some of us who were doing the planning part, but he was absolutely right. And he took all the men for the rest of the session, and they did some other kinds of things, you know, like making sure you had a will, things like that, but not the same kind of nurturing sorts of things that we're talking about in here.
Huh.
That it was just, and so when I'm thinking about what you're saying about seminaries, who's been responsible for curriculum in the years in seminaries?
That's very interesting. You know, I never would have.
So anyway,
added that possible dimension.
We do in my church. We have the widows group that meets on a regular basis, and
you
they
know,
do a lot
thing
of different things.
I think is that my father is very much alone now, and I think I would love it if there was someone in his church, a man, a widower, who had lost his wife, who would go to visit my dad once every 2 weeks, or who would call him up and take him out for coffee or something. There's got to be a man who's a widower there who could do that and just be his friend. So
I mean, look at the problems they've had with even in an active men's group, let's face it, in most of our churches. You know,
ours has just started.
They do the church repair kinds of stuff,
right.
The property kinds of stuff, mm-hmm. But it's really hard, and we just now have a nucleus of men who were talking about when the women had their retreat this last year. How come we don't have a retreat?
Uh-huh.
Great.
Why haven't we ever gone?
We had the third retreat, but our first retreat, women had to bribe their husbands to go. Do you have a men's retreat at your place? No. Men did not want to go to this men's retreat. And finally, because of all different reasons, women got some of their men to go, and they came back and they had this sort of smug look about, well, it was good, but we can't really say what went on. And they finally got real with each other, but they didn't tell each other too much. But every year since then, our list has gotten longer and longer, and there have been men on the waiting list now to go. But it's that they're first discovering that they can be real with each other, and it doesn't have to be this macho, I can deal with anything kind of thing. And just this sense of that women have had for so long of being able to share on a very personal level is something that men haven't quite been allowed permission to.
Coming into the new church, the women brought wonderful gifts to the new church. There wasn't anything in the men's movement to compare to.
Mm-hmm. I'm obviously prejudiced, but I think that the ordination of women has made a much richer ministry, or just a much richer church. We're using all kinds of, you know, we're bringing more in there